Hello and welcome to the Consistency Project Podcast. Every week here on the show, we aim to simplify the science of nutrition, health, and fitness, cutting through the noise to focus on the principles and practices that will help you perform better, feel better, and of course, live better. My name is Patrick Cummings here with just a quick introduction to the show this week. Thanks, of course, for tuning into it. We've got a fantastic conversation with Alan Aragon this week. You may recognize that name as we've talked about him and his research in episodes past. Alan Aragon is a nutrition researcher and educator with over 30 years of success in the field. He is known as one of the most influential figures in the fitness industry's movement toward evidence-based information. His book, Flexible Dieting, is one of the few books EC recommends. And as you'll hear at the end of this conversation, she also recommends he does a monthly research review called the Alan Aragon Research Review. Links for both the book and the research review are in the show notes. Without any further ado, here is EC with Alan Aragon.
Alan, thank you so much for coming on the Consistency Project today.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yes. Yeah. I've told my audience before, because I've mentioned your book once or twice, that I can't count the number of times I've searched a topic and then put Alan Aragon into Google search so that I could figure out what you were saying amongst the noise. And so it's so wonderful to have you on the show, because I think you do such a wonderful job of debunking things and setting people straight. And so I'm excited to get in a few topics with you. So yeah, so one of the things I was actually listening to, a relatively recent podcast you did, and it just really struck me. You made this comment that many have succeeded in spite of bro science, not because of it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just so awesome, because you cut through all the noise all the time and you're telling people don't pay attention to this gimmick and that gimmick. But I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Well, what can we learn about that in the sense of, you know, what do we really need to drive success in fitness or nutrition? And maybe also for the listeners, just when you think about bro science, maybe one or two examples of that, and then how, what do we really learn in terms of our success, what we truly need?
Yeah, bro science contains a hidden wisdom of its own. I mean, it's mainly for those who are unfamiliar, bro science is in the trenches, in quotes, wisdom from athletes and competitive athletes and recreational athletes and weekend warriors who think they're doing a great job. There are these rituals and beliefs that are not supported by the scientific literature, but they are just done as a matter of tradition and just as a matter of dogma and belief that these agents and protocols will actually enhance results somehow. So that's what bro science is. The bros in the trenches do it, so therefore it must be effective and it must be true. Mm. So the thing about these rituals, like, for example, supplementing with branched chain amino acids on top of a pre-existent abundance of total daily protein intake. I mean, this is something that's really common amongst a range of different types of athletes, not just physique athletes. Okay. But it works in spite of and not because of the fact that it's being done, because it doesn't harm anything. Other than maybe, I don't know, your monthly budget for supplements or whatever. But it certainly doesn't hurt anything. And it may even help in the sense of keeping somebody structured and fully loaded with the placebo effect. Yeah. And there's even different things that may work even beyond placebo effect. Like, for example, intra-workout amino acids and or amino acids plus some sort of carbohydrate source. Those kind of things can default people towards better hydration. It can potentially enhance mood while training, which can drive performance. And so there's blurred lines there between bro science being totally brotacular versus actually having some sort of physiological effect. So to tie the answer together, bro science may just have psychogenic mechanisms behind its effectiveness, but it also provides some sort of structure to these programs, and it helps people actually feel like they're pulling out all the stops possible to get the best results possible. And, you know, that approach actually, it works. It's very common amongst athletes at the highest level. They have their own funny little rituals that work, not because of them, of the ritual, but in spite of the ritual.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always interesting to me what thinking about the downstream effects. It's just, oh, I feel better drinking this, and therefore, because I feel better, I'm going to push harder during the workout or something like that. And so the results are maybe from the pushing harder during the workout, right? But it's that initial I feel in the moment. So yeah, it is hard from a science point of view to always discount all of these things because you see all the potential downstream effects while knowing, you know, the BCAAs aren't just slapping on the extra muscle mass on their biceps.
That's right. That's right.
Which kind of leads me to the second one. And I think I wouldn't say that it's all bro science, but there's a lot in the gym culture about your protein timing. And I've definitely seen your research about it. And I've, again, heard what you say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I believe it's something around you're willing to say 90 to 95%, you know, of your results will come from just focusing on that total quantity of protein during the day, not necessarily, oh gosh, I got to have it right after my workout or something like that. And that maybe that last 5% might be icing on the cake. And so I was kind of curious, first of all, do you have any data to say, you know, how much we could expect in terms of gains for that maybe last 5%? I know 5%, obviously, but do you have any data to kind of quantify what that icing on the cake might be?
Yeah. And let me clarify, the when I throw out that number, that the protein timing and distribution is like will get you that extra 5 to 10%. It's more in reference to specifically to the distribution of protein throughout the course of the day. So in other words, the patterning of your protein dosing intake, whether you have two meals a day, two protein feedings a day, versus like four protein feedings a day, given the same total daily amount. And so that was what I was referencing when I said that, oh, well, you know, you'll get, if you get your total daily protein right, then you've covered like 90 to 95% of your results. And then you can eke out the last like 5 to 10% if you distribute those constituent doses of the total in this sort of idealized way. And where I got that 90 to 95% of the total from, or 90 to 95% of your potential from just hitting the daily total is from a bunch of different studies. But I mean, the standout ones would be, so there's a set of studies looking at muscle protein synthesis. So muscle protein synthesis for the listeners is this short-term index of what might indicate a trajectory of muscle growth over time. So muscle protein synthesis is typically measured over a few hours to like, the course of a day. And so a standout study in this area was done over 10 years ago by Jose Arreta and colleagues, where they compared different protein distributions, a more idealized one with four doses versus two doses versus eight doses of a, you know, unideal total. But nevertheless, the ideal dosing pattern, the four doses, four 20 gram doses, it actually is what it was, that caused roughly 20 to 25% greater muscle protein synthesis compared to the other dosing distributions. And now this was over a 12-hour period, and it was just measured muscle protein synthesis. You can't measure changes in muscle mass, or certainly not, you know, performance and stuff and strength performance over that short time period. Right. So we have, let's say we have about a 20% advantage there if we're looking at just short-term muscle protein synthesis. Now, those type of studies are useful, but they're more hypothesis generating than anything else, because what we need to do is look at things longitudinally over a period of weeks or months and see what happens at the end of the rainbow when the rubber meets the road, and we're actually measuring things like changes in body composition, like actual growth of lean tissue. So one example that stands out is Yasuda and colleagues, I believe, where they compared an evenly distributed protein intake over three meals versus a skewed protein intake over those three meals with a small protein dose at breakfast and moderate and then large at dinner versus relatively even. So this is where that really small edge can be gained, because the evenly distributed protein intake, and this was among resistance trainees who were, they were not resistance trained prior to the study. So there's issues there that can be discussed. Oh. But nevertheless, the even distribution resulted in greater lean mass gains by the end of the 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And although the effect size was large, the actual absolute differences between the groups was about 1%. So the group that trained with this evenly distributed protein intake over the 12 weeks, they gained about less than a kilogram of body weight more lean mass, less than a kilogram more lean mass than the group that consumed this skewed distribution of protein intake. So although the difference was there, it was very small. So when you look at the muscle protein synthesis research, and then you look at the longitudinal research that measures changes in body composition, well, the latter should be weighted more if you were to compare the two in terms of their magnitude, their importance, in terms of their ability to convey what's really going on. So one can argue that, well, perfectly distributing your protein will get you the extra 1% if you look at longitudinal studies, or it can get you 20% more muscle protein synthesis if you look at the short-term acute studies that are mainly hypothesis generating. So when I say 90 to 95%, I'm really kind of shooting in between those two.
Okay.
It's more of a subjective and sort of conceptual type of heuristic than an actual thing. Because if I want it to be super precise, not necessarily precise, but very explicit, it would be a little more vague for me to say, you know, you can get somewhere between 1% to 80% of an advantage by messing with protein distribution, depending on what type of research you're looking at. I think it's more like in the middle of those guys.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you walking through all of that.
I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. And I'm familiar with those studies, and I really do appreciate you walking through. I'm not trying to hold you those numbers. I'm not trying to take it out of context and said, you know, well, Alan said this. I think, you know, one of the things that I deal with all the time with my clients is I really focus on consistency and even optimizing total protein intake before I worry about a perfect timing schedule. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, that might be kind of for, you know, the advanced athlete or somebody who's really pursuing a certain very hypertrophy, you know, and that's really their goal. Yeah. But I think the way that I say it, it almost sounds like I'm keeping them in the beginner camp for too long. You know, they're thinking to themselves, well, I'm pretty good at this EC. Maybe I should move on to the next step. And I just always want to be like, I don't know if you really need to, because I think there might be some other issues there, including consistency. So I guess that kind of leads to that second part that I was thinking, like, how do you know, or what really guides you when you're working with individuals to really push them towards these more theoretically optimal places instead of just kind of this consistency of the essentials of intake and making sure that overall volume's complete or adequate?
Yes. That's a really good question, because there's a lot of gray area there. It's not so easy as to say, well, as long as the person is in formal competition, then you better pull out all these stops.
Right.
And as long as the person is not in competition, who cares, type of thing. Because there are some people who are not in formal competition, but they're very serious, even though they're recreational athletes. So I think that anytime somebody is trying to go beyond the norm, then you can introduce these sort of ideas to them. And we'll take the muscle hypertrophy example of how it relates to protein distribution through the day. So if somebody habitually consumes most of their protein in two meals a day, mm-hmm. and their goal, they come to you and say, hey, I suddenly want to look like this superhero. Look, I want to look like Dwayne Johnson now. Mm. And so, how are we going to do this? And so then you would implement some of these optimization hypotheticals. Like, for example, making sure that protein is distributed through the course of the day, through a minimum of three feedings. And if somebody's really pushing it, sometimes it's more practical and easier and may even be more effective to get them four protein dosings through the course of the day. If they're really that far down the line towards their potential and they're really trying to eke out the last bit. But I think that as long as somebody is trying to strive for a goal that's sort of beyond average, I think it's mm-hmm. it's warranted to pull out these hypothetical stops, but I think you also have to always meet the client where they are in terms of scheduling and in terms of just how they handle programs just psychologically. You know, sometimes the stakes are not high enough to push somebody towards a four protein dosing day where each protein dose is somewhere between 0.4 to 0.6 grams per kilogram of body weight to maximize muscle hypertrophy over time, at least in theory.
Yeah, yeah. Which I guess really kind of also leads to the next thing. And that is, I feel like, you know, I've definitely heard you talk about protein a lot. I've certainly talked about protein a lot. I think we can fixate on protein intake. And oh my gosh, is my protein perfectly distributed? And I sometimes think some of the other variables that really can add to that person's success are overlooked, that we might be thinking about how do I maximize protein intake and kind of drop some of the other balls that we need to be juggling. And this, I know, could be a whole podcast on it. So that wasn't my intent with this, but kind of what are some of the other diet factors or even some of the exercise, big picture arcs and lifestyle factors that you'd really, let's take that same person who kind of gives you the Dwayne Johnson physique and like, this is where I'm going for. In addition to this potentially distribution of protein, what else are you really looking for in their diet, but also their, again, exercise and lifestyle does need to be in place to maximize those lean gains?
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, well, if we really sort of pan back, it begins with getting enough sleep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, thank once you.
Take a step way back, it begins with getting enough sleep.
Managing
the psychological stressors in your life, so you can prioritize focus on the program. A lot of people think that they can take on a program to achieve these kinds of goals, but they don't even have the schedule and the structural foundation to even begin to get it done. So until you can, get your sleep right, get stress management right. And then from that point, you really are looking at protein and calories sort of at the same time. And then you just sort of fill in the rest of it with the performance demands. If we're talking about carbohydrate and fat proportion, and then people always have to, well, you don't have to, but you should pay attention to diet quality if you care about long-term health. And for dieters, if they care about satiety, there's going to be some special considerations there for the types of food that they consume. But for this particular goal that we're talking about, it's a matter of the big rocks would be get enough sleep, pay attention to protein and total calories so you can actually have the raw materials to facilitate growth, and then make sure resistance training is integrated there and make sure it's progressive. And make sure the variables with the resistance training program allow enough recovery to remain progressive. So that's sort of the nutshell big picture of that.
Yeah. Yeah. With the sleep, do you really see that as the foundation to allow the intense exercise sessions? Is that really why that's almost what popped in your head at first? Or was it almost more from the standpoint of controlling appetite a little bit? Or why did your mind just go right away to, I need this sleep?
Yeah. It's because it's sort of the master controlling factor of how well you're going to perform, both physically and mentally. And without that foundation, and now granted, there are a lot of people in the world who can subsist on suboptimal sleep their whole lives. And there are a lot of people who can run on very low sleep for relatively long periods of time before these decrements in physical and mental performance start actually manifesting. But with you know, without a doubt, if people can optimize sleep or at least get this statistical minimum of 7 hours, and that's a big number to a lot of working people. You know, a lot of people are just 5-6 houring it for most of their adult lives. But you know what? Those are not the people who are going to maximize athletic goals that are progressive, especially a goal like increasing muscle mass. You know, that requires progressive effort and even maximizing endurance. You know, you're not going to be able to train for that if you don't have enough battery charging going on average per night.
Yep. Yeah. No, I'm so glad you say it. Sometimes I like to tell my clients, I think the best diet is to get consistent sleep because of the effects it has on their appetite ability, right? So now here from the performance perspective, you're saying the same thing. So that's awesome. I love to hear that.
Oh, yeah. The amount of calories people consume just through increased cravings from a lack of sleep is not only just statistically significant, it's pretty substantial. And it can be a major saboteur to people's weight loss, fat loss goals if they're not getting enough sleep because they're just hungrier through the day.
Totally. Okay, so we're sticking on some lean mass gains. My audience, I let you know, tends to be a CrossFitting functional fitness type group. So they're always looking for those more gains as well. And one of the concerns I hear about a lot is kind of what happens with aging, especially post 40, and that, you know, your potential for muscle mass gain isn't quite as high as it used to be. And I believe, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in your book, you kind of reference that there's the potential at an upper end for men to put on maybe 1 to 2 pounds a month of muscle mass, and then women would be half of that. Of course, that comes down with time and as you put on more muscle mass. But can you give us some sense of what that might look like for people kind of 40 plus in terms of potential for muscle mass gains, and why we shouldn't just all throw in the towel and say, well, we're getting older. Oh, well, I guess there's nothing to be done here.
Yes. So, okay. So we would kind of begin at the aerial view of total muscle gain potential over the course of a training career or over an adult lifetime. So, if we look at men, the average amount of muscle that a man can put on in adulthood compared to an untrained male adult, you know, these numbers vary, but you're looking at right around 40 to 45 pounds on the upper end. So that would be your drug-free potential for muscle gain beyond an untrained adult male. Mm-hmm. Women are about half of that. Okay, so if we say like 25 pounds max over an adult training career for a potential for muscle gain beyond an untrained female, looking at about 25 pounds. So on the male side, 40, 45 pounds on the female side, 20 to 25 pounds. If you take an average of the annual gain of both of those, it's just very small. If you look at, let's say, a 10-year training career, consistent training career, gosh, you know, it's pretty dismally small amount. Now, in theory, people can condense their 40-pound gain or their 20-pound gain into a 3 to 5 year period, if they have the time and the space, in their life to just dedicate their lives to training for that 3 to 5 year period. But most people don't. For most people, it's a 10-year trek. And so, you're really looking at an average of 4 to 8 pounds a year if you're lucky. If you're lucky. Sure. And so, okay, so getting back to your question, I just wanted to kind of provide some perspective there. And sure, the shape of how those gains happen, it's more at the beginning and it diminishes towards the end of your potential. But nevertheless, it's still a small amount per year, 4 to 8 pounds, if that. If you do everything right.
Right.
so given that, if somebody is, for example, 40 years old, and typically people peak out in their structural capacity for muscle gains. And we know this observationally. If you look at the absolute champs of gaining muscle on the planet, like the Mr. Olympia competitors, they are... So observationally, the longest reigning Mr. Olympia competitors achieved it in their mid-30s to late 30s, early 40s even. And then nobody seems to be able to hold on to that Olympia title after their early 40s. The younger guys just come over and just boot them out of the spot. So... unless you're somebody who has come very close to their ultimate muscular potential in your 40s, as a male, take inventory. You still have, that potential of 40 pounds of muscle to put on. Well, I'm okay. 20 to 40 pounds
sure.
of muscle, but 40 pounds, 40, 45 pounds on the upper end to put on. Depending on how much of that you've gained in your adult life thus far. It gets tougher to put on muscle seemingly when people cross over 60, 65 years old. But that's statistically at the general population level. Hypothetically, you can take somebody who's trained very carefully and hasn't hurt themselves and has stayed relatively healthy throughout their lives. And let's say they never had the goal of fulfilling their muscular potential until they hit 50 or 60. They're like, I want to fulfill my muscular potential. If they have, let's say, 10 to 20 pounds left over of that 20 to 40-ish pounds available to them, they can do it. it's just the motivation to do it might not be there. The life constraints, the resources might not be there. But in theory, you can take an 85-year-old man, and if he's untrained and deconditioned, you can just train that 85-year-old muscle to essentially behave like 40-year-old muscle once you get the training process started.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think people can, get a little defeatist maybe when there's so many cases or people who will start later and actually find that they have a much different physique potentially than when they were younger, right? Because they just haven't been a trained athlete yet, right? And so I like to encourage people to start regardless or to continue regardless. But yes, thank you. Thank you for all that. I feel like I've seen some research even with octogenarians and resistance training and some increases that they're able to make, right? So that's never too late. More gains.
It is never too late. Muscle is a very kind of malleable type of thing. And it's relatively easy to rejuvenate muscle as long as you just challenge it, train it.
And you would say the same thing for females aging as well, of course, knowing that their overall bank is a little bit less.
Yes, that's true. That is absolutely true. Their overall bank is less, but the potential to get things back going again and make gains in the, in quotes, golden years is definitely possible. And it's been demonstrated in the literature too.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for that and setting the record on that. I think there's some interesting themes on the internet that are sex specific. We might get into a little bit of that in a little bit here too. One of the other things that I was hoping that you could help with is talking about carbs and their importance with maximizing performance or fitness. And again, knowing that my audience has sort of a CrossFit functional fitness high intensity background. There tends to be some trends within the community that I've fallen for as well in some of my earlier years of super low carb and higher fat. And so is there a point or type of activity or duration at which you might start to think more about using a higher fat diet? Or where do carbs come in the mix in terms of maximizing performance?
Yeah, that is a great question. You know, all these questions you're asking are just super super great, because there's a lot of contingencies and a lot of rabbit holes to go down.
A lot of rabbit holes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, okay. So the simple dimple answer, which I'll add some nuance to, is that there really is no point where, generally speaking, there really is no point where lowballing carbs would be beneficial to performance. However, the nuance to that is, for endurance athletes and for performance athletes in general, if they can do what researchers have called fueling for the work required, match the carbohydrate intake to the demands of the given training day, then some training days will be very mellow, like a moonlight walk through the park or a moonlit stroll. So therefore, the demand for carbohydrate would be very low on those sessions or on those days. And so if somebody's trying to match the fuel intake with the training demand, then you wouldn't need a whole lot of carbohydrates on that for that session or for that day. So you can technically, you can low carb or, you know, keto it that day. And then on other days that there is a higher demand, higher intensity, higher volume, and or both, then you fuel for the work required, and then that could be a high carb day. And so depending on the athlete, depending on the individual situation, depending on how much they want to economize on their total energy intake, then you can use carbs as sort of that variable factor that you can either raise or lower depending on the demand. And so I think that might be the smartest way to go about carb intake for these sorts of things. But I don't subscribe to the idea that there's a maybe a universal point or a type of sport or activity that would benefit more from carb restriction than others.
Right. Yeah. Even some of the kind of the lower moderate endurance stuff, you don't really see a place for kind of that high fat type of fueling for kind of, I don't know, the multi-milers, multi-day endurance events. You would still see a place for carbs there.
Yeah.
Do I have that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And we have Louise Burke and her group to thank for maybe the best research, the most diligently controlled research on that question.
Yeah. Good. So then maybe you can help some people understand. So why are they seeing some gains if they're doing CrossFit on keto, or if they're doing, you know, fasting and CrossFit and stuff like that? Why are they seeing some gains on these diets that we don't see kind of the research play out in the direction that maybe we're advocating for more carbs? And I know there could be a lot of ways, but I'd love to get your take, because this is one that I field often.
Okay, so fundamentally, the body is very good at endogenously generating glucose. You know, we can do it from lactate, we can do it from glucogenic amino acids, we can do it from a number of pathways to create our own carbohydrates and refill our own glycogen stores. But it just does not occur to the same degree as if you were to have exogenous carbs or carbs from the diet. So a memorable example would be research from, oh, I forgot the actual author's last name, but it was endurance athletes who were on keto versus endurance athletes who were on the standard high carb, low fat diet. And the keto endurance athletes carried about half the muscle glycogen as the athletes on the high carb diet. And there are bits and pieces in the literature that are exceptional, like Volek and colleagues. They did the FASTER study, comparing the muscle glycogen levels of elite endurance athletes on keto versus non-keto, and they found no significant difference in the amount of resting muscle glycogen that they carried. But there's more evidence pointing to the reality that you are going to carry less muscle glycogen if you are on keto versus high carb. Even though somebody may be ketoing it through CrossFit, they will still be able to perform, maybe even progressively. They'll still be able to, let's say somebody wasn't doing CrossFit, they were just bodybuilding, trying to put on muscle. They'll still be able to gain muscle. So, but there's a big difference between these gains happening versus these gains being maximized. So you'll notice there's no world champ CrossFitters who are on linear keto. None, like zero. Yeah. There are no Olympic gold medalists ever in the history of the Olympics. We picked the performance sport who were on linear ketogenic diets. Or even close to that. Just, you know.
Right.
So I mean, it's just a reality of human physiology that, hey, you can make progress. You can make gains. Your performance can improve without carbohydrates. But you won't be getting world-class firsts if you take that route. And and for some people, that's fine. Because for a lot of folks, they prefer that level of restriction. It helps them control their impulses. It helps them default to not consuming, you know, these carb, fat, heavy, highly refined and processed junk foods. And that's fine. But my issue is when somebody claims that, hey, this is the universal best way to go, instead of saying, hey, this is what works best for me. And I don't care about being world class in terms of my competition. So that's where my issues are.
Awesome. Well, you kind of brought up some of the Olympians in the world class. One of the things that I think I've thought about a little bit is, where do performance and health really diverge from one another? I have seen some association studies actually suggesting that high level performance and longevity are associated, and I can speculate on different reasons why. I'm sure you can as well. Yeah. But where do you think they realistically diverge? And would there be any biomarkers or other indicators for people who are pushing performance at a relatively high level to kind of keep in check or be aware of?
This is a great question. And it's almost almost a philosophical question.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. But I thought you could handle it, Alan.
Yeah, I appreciate your faith in me for this one. I think, okay, so the old NASM, under the old National Academy of Sports Medicine, under the Bob Goldman regime, when Tom Purvis and Mitch Simon were the head guys of National Academy of Sports Medicine, before Mike Clark came over, and before the current incarnation of NASM, their definition of sport was really cool, and it really stuck with me. And so definition of sport is anything that pulls your body apart and challenges you to hold it together. So
that is good.
So given that,
okay,
I honestly, like, from a philosophical perspective, I think that health and longevity and competitive sport almost have a conflict inherently from the very beginning. So now, this is not to say that competitive sport can enhance longevity by, for example, defaulting people into a low body fat levels and or favorable or high levels of lean body mass, including skeletal density. So the sport can default people into that, but it always rides this line between longevity and injury, whether the injury is acute, immediate, catastrophic, or whether it is wear and tear over time injury. And I think that with the endurance athletes, they and the physique athletes, they are subject to wear and tear injury. Mm-hmm. And this obviously injury obviously impacts health. The strength and power athletes, power lifters, strength athletes, you know, strong men and impact athletes, mixed martial arts, football, rugby. Those guys subject themselves to a wide range of negative health effects, in spite of getting, you know, ideal body composition, ideal levels of fitness. And on the endurance side, you know, VO2 max has been associated with longevity. But there's always this competition between the sport pulling your body apart as you are challenged to hold your body together. And so if we were to look at the stereotypical longevity champs, the Blue Zone folks, or even if we go straight to the Okinawans, they're doing nothing that looks like competitive sport. You know, they're if anything, they're just competitively humming and whistling while they're gardening. Right. And so, I read that question when you sent me it over email, and I thought to myself, how on earth am I going to answer this thing? So I guess that's the best I can do.
No, I love it. I mean, you know, CrossFit has a competitive edge to it. I think there's, of course, like every sport, there's different levels of it. Some people are doing it professionally, and then some people are pushing themselves really hard. And it's always been sort of tossed around as, okay, you know, at what point are you entering this competitive realm, and is it too much? And, you know, I know that there's not one answer. I'm not trying to pin you to one answer, but it is interesting. What do those habits of being competitive for a period of life set you up for maybe later in life, right? Like maybe you're not going to continue weightlifting at that same level forever, but like you said, maybe it leads to the lower body fat throughout life or even the nutrition around life. So I just wanted to get your take on it because, again, I thought you could handle it and I do like your answer. I love that definition.
Well, I'll tell you what, it probably varies with the sport. So I know a lot of powerlifters who are trying to survive their former powerlifting career.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine the same thing with football too, right? That kind of really banged up, right?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And I know a lot of people in various sports who are trying to survive their performance enhancing drug use. Mm-hmm. And there's a full range of those type of things that you can use that either can help you or harm you or both. I know a lot of endurance athletes who are trying to survive their former endurance career, especially in terms of things like plantar fasciitis, knee issues and ankle issues and all of that stuff. CrossFit has gotten its share of criticism from various angles throughout the years, but you know, when you really take a step back, it's a mix of stressors on the body with the strength and endurance. And as long as people don't overdo it, as with anything, it's actually a good, good mix of demands for making sure that you're fit in, a multitude of facets. And thus far, one thing we do know for sure is that at the CrossFit crowd, they are the gods and the goddesses. They look like gods and goddesses, as you mentioned. So sometimes that's all that matters.
Right. That's the best metric. I want to be respectful of your time. Hopefully you'll have time for this last question so we can end some of the internet drama, perhaps, about the women. We're going to try anyway, Alan, women versus men. And I appreciated so much in your book, Flexible Dieting, which I recommend all the time.
Thank you.
Because you were very clear about some of the lack of evidence we have about sex-specific differences. So how does or does not knowing the sex of your client really change your nutrition advice? What are the practical differences that really matter in your opinion versus where do you see maybe some stuff online, social media land that people get a little too hung up on?
Yeah, okay, so there's not a whole lot of research on the protein needs of women versus men. I mean, there's maybe enough for us to say they're about the same. Mm-hmm. But the reality of the matter is these small differences are hard to detect in research. You know, research is always going to be this rough sort of broad stroke that you try to make some sense out of when the study is done, and you hope that the people complied with the protocol, and you know, you hope that you worked the statistical calculations accurately. But the fact of the matter is women have roughly almost double the body fat of men on average. And if we're to just assign protein on total body weight, we may be slightly over prescribing for women. But then again, it may be just a testament to how much of a non-issue and how innocuous it is to overconsume protein to a significant degree. Our bodies are perfectly fine at it. Mm-hmm. There are differences in fuel use or substrate oxidation during training with men and women. So women have a greater tendency to oxidize more fatty acid than men do during training. This doesn't mean that it's time to, feed that forward and put women on a higher fat diet or a lower fat diet or make any changes according to that, because women also store more fatty acids than men do after the training bout. So it just kind of comes out even. One thing, and also there's this great review by D'Souza last year. This is a great review to check out by Alicia D'Souza, and it's in the Journal of Applied Physiology. It was published in December of 2023. And the title is Menstrual Cycle Hormones and Oral Contraceptives, a Multi-Method Systems Physiology-Based Review of Their Impact on Key Aspects of Female Physiology. And essentially, this review looked at all of the claims around how women should train or eat or both according to the menstrual cycle. And what they found overall was this lack of evidence for prescribing specific protocols depending on what point in the menstrual cycle you're at. And it was a consistent lack of evidence that were supporting these, almost like these claims that were almost taken like foregone conclusions. Like, duh, of course you're supposed to eat this way at this point in the cycle, and this way and that you're supposed to train that way. And this, what they found was, look, what we need to do is deal with the client or the athlete on an individual basis and just auto-regulate the protocol according to when they have the most and least energy and motivation, depending on how they feel as an individual through the course of their cycle. The only consistent thing that I've seen in clients with respect to potentially beneficial changes in the menstrual cycle is when women's cravings are kind of through the roof, in the premenstrual period, like the week premenstrual or so. That, in my experience, happens to be a good time to allow or give clients permission to go on some sort of a diet break or a restriction deloading. Yes. And then, it works out just fine to where they're dieting harder in the 3 weeks prior to the week that their cravings are through the roof, and they just sort of follow their cravings on that. And so really, that's the only thing that I've found works with respect to changes protocol-wise as a result of female physiology. Otherwise, the evidence just isn't there.
Yes, thank you. Say it louder. I feel like there's a lot out there that suggests women need a lot of specific protocols. And I continually say no, but I'm so thankful that you do as well. And was really happy to see you put down those claims in your book. But thank you so much for all of your time. And if people don't know who you are, which I'm sure they do, but to follow you on social media, your book also, Flexible Dieting. It's, I think in the intro, you said that you were always asked about good nutrition books. And so you finally wrote one. And so thank you for that. And then also your research review, which is so great because people also want to know how to debunk stuff. So monthly, you kind of have a research review that will go over new studies, correct?
That's right. Been doing it since January 2008. Every month for the last 16-ish years, put out a research review issue. I actually started the model in the industry. A bunch of really brilliant, you know, students and colleagues copied me and are doing well with their research reviews. But I have to remind people, hey, I started this thing. And my review is cheaper than almost everybody's because they try to one-up me in terms of the amount of like content that they cover a month. But I'm thinking, you know, people, you know, not everybody has the time to read all of that. But so I'm biased towards thinking mine is the one everybody should be subscribed to. But no, yeah, I do think that everybody should be subscribed to my research review.
Yeah. No, it is awesome. And it's a wonderful resource. So
thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the Consistency Project, Alan.
EC, you are awesome. Thank you so much for this. And thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week. Thank you to Alan for his time and his wisdom and his work. Check out the links in the show notes for more from him. And EC and I will be back next week for a new episode of the Consistency Project Podcast.